Super K.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Johnny Jungle Guts.
And I'm Professor Extra.
And you're listening to Super Gay, the podcast where we talk about all things gay in comics and more.
But mostly comics.
Now, Alex.
Yeah.
Professor Extra. Mm-hmm. As we all know, we are in a pandemic moment.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think that's what's informing our decision to do this episode. But let's just talk about what's been going on and how we've been doing, what have you been working on. You told me you were doing some translation for comics.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, so a trade that I figured out with Luciano Vecchio was I would trade working on his comic, Sereno, which I love, and so as a sort of fan, encouraged him to get a translation into English so that he could put it up on Comixology. So I traded basically working as an editorial person and helping get that translation into English in exchange for him teaching me his tricks on Clip Studio, which is an application that he uses to make comics on his iPad. And I used it for the Artform 4-page piece that I made at the beginning of the pandemic. So he's been showing me on Zoom how to do a bunch of things. And I've been diving deep into his beautiful world of Sereno, which is a story about a superhero who's trying to keep his city from becoming totally insane and ruined by all these forces that keep popping up to do that, which is something that I think we're kind of dealing with in New York City right now. So I identified pretty closely with the piece. So keep your eyes open for Sereno, S-E-R-E-N-O, by Luciano Vecchio. It'll be up on Comixology.
All right. Well, look out for that. On Comixology, do they require all the comics to be in English, or it just makes more sellable?
Yeah, I think he just wants to put an English text version out there so that fans who don't read Spanish will have access to
it. Well, that's great. I have been, as I think I said on the last episode even, doing a lot of obsessive drawings of Dungeons and Dragons maps and preparing a Dungeons and Dragons game for my family, actually, where they, like, all the NPCs are sort of recast as, like, people like that we grew up with. So so that's, like, one of the main things I've been working on, because I thought they were coming out for my wedding in June, and then now I sort of think that I'm going to be going to my sister's wedding in the fall, but also wondering if I'm actually not going to see them until Christmas. So the way I keep rationalizing each of these shifts is like, well, now I have more time to work on these drawings, because that's like my little, like, silver lining is like, oh, well, now these drawings are going to be even more elaborate. So
D&D, I do think, is this a beautiful space outside of it in some ways. I've been playing Dungeons and Dragons with these people in Europe who are in quarantine in Berlin and in parts of the UK. And it's been a really interesting experience. One thing that with that group, they're really funny because most of them are not longtime players, though the DM is and I am, and they don't like combat at all. They find it so boring. They don't care. They're like, why are we fighting this person again? Okay, I guess we have to just, you know, roll initiative. They really don't, they don't like it. So now the DM is kind of at his wit's end, and he's going to have to start to really work on his non-player characters and give them, like, actual motivation and personalities and stuff. He has made good world building. I really like his world, but he needs to kind of step it up with the NPCs, because none of the players really want to fight anybody. They just want to have conversations as other people. And my character did get laid recently. My guy is a druid elf, and he's kind of an activist, a sort of ecological druid elf activist. And, you know, he used wild shape to become a wolf and hung out with a wolf pack, which was a really fun and liberating feeling. But he did have sex recently with a sea elf, and that took a lot of work. And that was actually, that I did feel more accomplished doing that than I did, you know, most of the other things I've done recently. I want to thank the listeners for buying The Context, published by Primary Information, which was the subject of our last episode, which is the comic book that I made over the last couple of years. And we saw that many of you did buy it, and so thank you so much. And I hope you enjoy it. And
yeah, that's even, the other, Even people who were who I was going to buy it for because they were Patreon members, they had already bought it before I got the chance to do so. Thank you, Anna Jones and John Merritt for that incredible gesture.
Thank you, and let me know what you think. You know, my favorite question is, who's your favorite character? It's always really interesting to me. It's almost like a kind of mini astrological thing that you get to choose, you know? We're going to be looking at how AIDS and HIV were represented in superhero comics in the 80s, 90s, and even early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And we're going to look at a couple case studies, and we're going to go mostly in chronological order, but we're going to start with comics that explicitly talked about HIV/AIDS. And there's the opposite, which is the X-Men, which always talks about everything through metaphor because the mutants are metaphors. So, and they talked about it very differently, and we'll kind of compare. I am writing an essay on this for Visual Aids, which is an institution that archives the work of artists living with AIDS and has a huge record of artists who died in the crisis, and maintains that archive so that people can make exhibitions out of them. But they also do a lot of other things like commission new works. So this is one of the things they're doing, is a show about AIDS and comics coming up. And I got the superhero essay job. And so this is actually some of my research from that, which I have been had a really hard time writing about, I'm going to admit. Maybe, Johnny, you can help me.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second, especially maybe for some of our straight listeners. Maybe we could just take a second. You know, you're a little older than me, and talk about our own relationships to HIV and AIDS, and maybe some of the experiences we've gone through as a result of those conditions. I don't know.
Well, you know, I came out in the early 90s when I started college, so I am probably significantly older than you, and AIDS, HIV were the conditions in which gay identity were being formed at that time. So even though I was young enough to have missed the years when nobody knew what was happening and so many people were, you know, there was no AIDS and safe sex education or anything like that, there was for me, maybe more even than there was for some of the generations that came after me. But it definitely informed how I thought about sex, how I thought about my life, how I thought about my potential future, how I thought about my sexuality. And luckily, there were artists in the world like Grand Fury and General Idea and Felix Gonzalez Torres and musicians like Madonna and the B-52s and others who, D-Light even, who brought attention to AIDS and HIV in ways that made it possible for me to imagine both like living in this world and surviving it. And that was really, really important because, you know, growing up in a homophobic environment, add AIDS to that, and it becomes extremely difficult to do things like come out of the closet, which it was hard to do because my parents were thought that that meant I was going to die immediately. And it probably also informed why I, you know, met somebody and stuck with them for a really long time. You know, Malik is my first boyfriend, and he's still my boyfriend and husband, I don't know. And, you know, we've been through a lot together, but... you know, we're going through another thing together now. And all I can say is that it is a sort of deeply rooted trauma, in a sense, to come out in that situation of the pandemic that was happening then. It's changed a lot because of PrEP. And, you know, I do have close friends and lovers who have been positive, many of them much younger than me. And I wonder if that has to do with a change in education. But the reality is I managed to make it to PrEP, and I think it has a lot to do with the kind of art education actually that I got around the time when it was most necessary.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still an ongoing thing, and issues with education are still maybe you're right, more of a problem than they even used to be. I had a friend who worked for the LGBT Center in Los Angeles, and he told me that many people who would come in and test positive for HIV did not really have any clue as to what it was. And that's just, I think, just an issue with an education system and just sort of access to education. You know, AIDS certainly disproportionately affects communities of color. Yeah. It's still, you know, even though I came out in 2003, it's still, you know, I've still had moments in my life, like having a close family member tell me I was going to die of AIDS because I didn't clean my room, so I was going to forget to wear a condom because I was a messy person. Or,
that's intense.
You know, just having other queer people tell me that I shouldn't date someone who's HIV positive because it was too risky. But you really have to evaluate risk in a different way. I mean, I think that's something we're thinking about probably more in these times. Because, you know, you also have to think about the risk of how you impact other people. And also, that right. wasn't a valid thing. You know, you can date someone who's HIV positive and have a perfectly healthy sex life, especially right. now with PrEP, but even then before PrEP.
Yeah,
you know, it was a wrong of other queer people to tell me that I needed to get out of this situation. You know what I mean? For those reasons.
Right. Yeah. So I think one thing we see when we look at comics from this arc of time, and actually it's interesting because the comics we're going to look at start in about 1988 and end around 2005. So they kind of are the period that we're talking about here, you know, from before me coming out to right after you came out.
Sure. Yes.
And so this is kind of a funny context for us to think about. And it's interesting to see how, you know, education around it really shifts, how the sense of what can possibly cause infection shifts, senses of how responsibility work shifts over this period, and then its kind of disappearance in a way in more contemporary comics is something else I think about. Let's start back in 1988-ish, 88-89, and this is a comic book that we talked about very recently called The New Guardians by Steve Englehart, Kerry Bates, and Joe Staton. And I just want to talk about it briefly because it is, as far as I understand, within mainstream comics, it's a DC comic book. One of the first times that AIDS ever gets mentioned directly. And in it, several superheroes are infected with HIV.
That's right.
What I wanted to talk about, I guess, with this, and we'll just sort of recap. I mean, you guys remember that it's a group of superheroes who are international, who were given powers by aliens, and they all seem like everything's going to be great. They have this mission to save the world. And then in the very first issue, a villain called the Hemogoblin appears, scratches that several of the teammate members, and then they all test positive for
HIV.
They test positive for HIV. And these characters include Jet, who is a black woman from the UK, Harbinger, who is a white woman from outer space, as far as I can tell, and Extraño, who we talked about at length recently, who is a Peruvian kind of wizard. And Extraño is never explicitly called gay, but they make a lot of different ways to make us know that he is. The Hemogoblin, the villain that scratched them, is from South Africa. He is a kind of pale, sickly, bald figure of illness. And he dies, you know, in custody after the heroes subjugate him. And that's how the authorities come to realize that he was... his superpower basically is spreading HIV. That is, you know, that's a situation, right, where a part of it also is, I mean, he scratches them and they become infected, that there's even this kind of suggested ignorance around how transmission occurs, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, obviously the idea is this is like sort of his like superpower, but at the same time, it's not, there's not like a lot of clarity going on.
No. And then, you know, the characters are all put in these terrible situations as a result of this, because several of them are now learning through finding out that they're positive about HIV, whereas Extraño, because he's from a gay community, presumably, he seems to know more about it already, and mm-hmm. perhaps even might have been positive beforehand. He's not
right.
Sure.
It might have been happened before the Hemogoblin.
Right. But one thing I wanted to just look at is there's a moment where Harbinger says to Jet, whose name is Celia. Let's just read that panel that starts with friends.
All right.
I'll read Harbinger.
All right.
Oh, Celia, how on earth will we be able to go on with this hanging over us?
Day by day, girl, we have to learn to live day by day.
And our glorious mission? What becomes of that? So I thought that panel was particularly interesting in light of the current situation we're in, where you do have this sense of something hanging over you. The potential, every move feels unsafe right now. And then Celia, who deals with the whole thing much better than Harbinger actually throughout, has that kind of word of wisdom, you know, that really mm-hmm. all we have is each day. And that feels very much like right now. And then even the response and our glorious mission, which what becomes of that, I think, yeah, that's kind of it, right? The disappointment we all have because we had so many plans for this future that we now feel is completely uncertain. This is an early representation of actually like gay friendship, and who comes from a gay community in Peru in this case. And there's a little flashback to Extraño visiting his friends back in Peru and talking about, you know, who got it and who didn't get it. He visits a cemetery and he talks about how so many of his friends are there. And so there is this kind of mourning, which is something that is very unusual in comics, actually, is to just sort of situate somebody within a space of remembrance and mourning. And he even has this kind of moment where he's thinking, well, why don't you read that? This is one of my favorite panels. It's this full page of Extraño in a forest with the sunbeam shooting through the trees. And he's kind of looking at a flower, and he's wearing his purple cape, and he's got his crazy hair. And the narration says,
I do not know if my future is to be measured in months, years, or decades. I tell you something. Life is hard.
So, you know, it's funny. When we read this originally, right, we had so much distance in a way from this. And it was almost like a curiosity, although I thought it was interesting. And Steve Englehart is, to me, a really interesting comics writer because he's always kind of showing you his struggle. But right now, looking at it, I do feel like it marks a kind of moment in which people were facing death and were acknowledging that. You know, a superhero is supposed to be able to overcome that and often does. But here you had a superhero just speaking directly to an audience saying that life is hard and they don't know what their future is. And right now I feel like that actually is resonant, you know?
It's very resonant. I mean, I think we see a lack of mourning in superhero comics because, you know, if you evaluate it, superheroes go through so many traumatic things, right? So much violence and just near-death experiences and da-da-da-da-da. You could, the feelings of trauma, if they were evaluated realistically, would be so overwhelming.
With that in mind, actually, I'd like to turn to Alpha Flight number 106 from 1992, so this is several years later, by Scott Lobdell, Mark Pennella, and Dan Panosian. And this is a famous issue in which North Star comes out, which we talked about in our North Star episode. But one of the things I was thinking was interesting about this is that his coming out coincides with, and is in fact kind of motivated by, a conversation around AIDS.
Right.
So this is one of the examples, like with Extraño, where you have a superhero's sexuality in the late 80s, early 90s, being framed in relationship to the AIDS crisis, much like my parents framed my own relationship to sexuality. And in fact, they were right. It was in relationship to that, one way or another. Do you remember this plot? Can you just like
I couldn't not remember this plot. Right. North Star finds a little infant abandoned girl who is HIV positive, and he adopts her, takes her to the hospital, and seeing this on TV is a superpowered Mountie-type figure, an older gentleman named Maple Leaf, who then attacks North Star, in the process of that fight, it's learned that Maple Leaf's son was a victim of HIV, and he is mad at North Star because North Star is getting all this attention for it, and his son is just completely forgotten. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And so North Star in the fight reveals and comes out as a way to talk to Major Maple Leaf about this. He says, "Do not presume to lecture me on the hardships homosexuals must bear. I am gay, be that as it may. AIDS is not a disease restricted to homosexuals as much as it seems the rest of the world wishes that were so." You know, he's been queer-coded for years, and all of a sudden he just announced his sexuality. Major Maple Leaf responds,
"By closeting yourself, you're as responsible for my son's death as the homophobic politicians who refuse to address the AIDS crisis."
And then North Star responds, "It is past time that people started talking about AIDS, about its victims, those who die, and those of us left behind." And then they hug. And I mean, it's funny how, you know, that particular issue of Alpha Flight, even though the art is bonkers, and I have a hard time with early 90s.
It's very 90s.
I have a hard time with the early 90s style because I'm just so not. That wasn't my moment. I was in college and I was not reading comics then, I think was like what was going on. But I feel like that issue is really interesting and a kind of really important turning point because all of a sudden the closet door swung open.
Yes, it did.
Super K.
So let's go to Hulk number 420. So now a year later, 2 years later, 1994, we have Peter David and Gary Frank giving us this issue of the Hulk, which has a really kind of stunning cover. It's all black with the Hulk kind of standing next to a brown-skinned man. He's got green skin, you know, so it's very evident, holding his hand while he's in a hospital bed. There's sort of a light beam, you know, on him, very focused, but most of the cover is black, and there's a little red ribbon in the corner. Do you want to talk about this? Like, tell him, I mean, I've never knew about this before, but somebody pointed it out to me and I read it, and I'm not a big Hulk fan, so I don't know all the lore, and I don't even really know who all the characters are, but we both read this, so what do you think? Thoughts?
Well, I'm in the same boat. I'm not a huge, I've certainly never read like large swaths of Hulk solo comics. But I am familiar with sort of what was happening in this period, which was a time when the Hulk had basically regained his faculties as a brilliant Bruce Banner scientist guy while he was in Hulk form. So he's not speaking in his typical sort of monster child type dialogue here. It's fully just Bruce Banner, but Hulked out. Yeah, this character, Jim Wilson, is kind of a stand-in for Rick Jones, who was an earlier Hulk sidekick. He was the guy that the Hulk saved by running out in the gamma field or whatever. Yeah, he always has some young upstart kid who's like tagging along. And so this one, Jim Wilson, who's actually a relative of Sam Wilson, the Falcon, and after his introduction, I believe, it's revealed that he's HIV positive and is now on his deathbed at this point, several issues later, dying of AIDS. So that's where we sort of find things here.
So he's already in, basically in hospice, and the request he makes of the Hulk is for a blood transfusion, saying, "If you give me a blood transfusion, I could survive the same way that your cousin, She-Hulk, you know, made into She-Hulk by getting a blood transfusion from you." And what is the Hulk's response?
To lie and tell him that he will do it, but then not actually do it and let him die. That is the Hulk's response. But at the same time, you know, She-Hulk was dying from blood loss. The Hulk doesn't really know what would happen if he did this blood transfusion.
Right. There's guarantee that it would work, but there's the possibility. And his reasoning, I guess, is that he has just gained control of his monstrous Hulk personality, which, I mean, every time I've read the Hulk stuff, it's always in the Defenders as a character who's just kind of funny. I don't know. So I don't know what he's so upset about. But anyway,
there are some really bizarre choices happening in this issue You know, I feel like Peter David in this moment of 1994 is writing from a space of such sort of hopelessness, yeah. You know? The other B-plot that's happening here is that Betty Brandt, who's the Hulk's wife, I think, at this point, it works at maybe like a call-in center for... I don't really know, but she ends up getting these phone calls from a guy who's tested HIV positive and is planning to kill himself, and the issue just sort of ends with him getting hit by a train. Maybe you don't really know what happens exactly.
Yeah.
Betty tries her best to, you know, it's sort of like you know, you're seeing Betty sort of model a certain set of compassion and good behaviors, but there's not like a guarantee that those will resolve things in a positive way. You know what
right.
I mean?
I mean, there is. Yeah, I think when you bring up the hopelessness, that is something that is definitely present here. And it's really hard to read on a number of levels. I think one of the things that is happening is that because... all of a sudden superheroes are dealing with a very real problem that has not been solved by humanity in any stretch, you know, any way at this point. They can't really have the Hulk give his blood to somebody and make them not HIV positive anymore. Like that just narratively feels so wrong in the height of a crisis to come, you know?
Yeah.
And so the fact that they even set that up as a problem is so insane, because on the level of just, the story in any other superhero comic book I've ever read, of course he would give him his blood. That's exactly what they would do. You know, they would find some kind of super way to make this something else. But in reality, at that moment, there was so little hope. So for any kind of cure, there still is no cure. There's treatment and there is prevention, but there's no cure. So they couldn't go there. And so they painted themselves into this incredible narrative corner. Jim says, "You'll be a hero, you know. Use your blood, make an antidote for everybody. You'll save thousands of lives." I mean, okay, they couldn't do that in the comic book. Like, okay, Hulk cures AIDS. Like, that would have never worked. So they've kind of show why they can't do it, but then they also couch it in a kind of narrative that ends up making it so that the black, young, HIV-positive person has to die. There's no other way out of this narrative. You know, as he's dying, he says to Hulk...
"That's right. That's how much stronger I feel. Shoot, I'm gonna leap out of this bed in just a couple minutes. Just gotta rest up a bit, and then you're gonna see some..." And then I guess that's when he passes away.
Right with a close-up, you know. I mean, I think there's like so many problems with this that I don't see in the other comics we were looking at, and I think it has a lot to do with using this subsidiary character as the place of putting... AIDS creates a problem that you don't see with Extraño, for example. It's somebody else. And even with North Star being gay, he is very much affected by it. But here it's like, True. Okay, you know, it's the brown body, it's the other, it's not the, even though he's green, the sort of white Superman in the middle of this.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the comic, as you pointed out, there's a lot of different characters that have some kind of position around HIV, including the guy who calls in and says he's suicidal. And then there's also another story, which is this kid named Joey Harris that's on the news all the time as a kind of backdrop for the entire issue. As they say in the comic book, AIDS-infected student Joey Harris is being forced to leave his school.
And Jim got beat up at the protest. That's why he ends up
right.
In the hospital.
So effectively, this all leads to his death. And this is a kid, one of the parents being interviewed says, "Look, I got to watch out for my own kid, you know? I feel for this kid. I mean, it's not like he's gay, you know?" And then the little kid shows up on screen and says, "I'm sorry I've made everyone upset."
It was heavy.
So that's the backdrop for this. And then you know, watching it is this couple of characters in a gym who look like super gay, both of them, one of whom I guess is. And what he's punching the bag and he's punching the bag at the gym and he says, "Man, this gay equals AIDS thing really burns me." And the other guy says,
"Well, you've got yourselves to blame for that, Hector. If you weren't all bed hopping or lounging in bathhouses, maybe..."
thwack, and there's a punch. He punches the guy, and he says, "I could spend half an hour telling you how wrong you are, Ulysses, but we'd have gotten to this eventually, so I figured I'd save time."
Remember when gay meant happy? I miss those days. I'm looking at these characters. I don't have a clue who they are, but their names are Hector and Ulysses. So there's some kind of mythological thing going on here.
Yeah, so a couple of people from the Iliad are... And you know, Hector is literally wearing just green shorts and nothing else while he's at the gym.
And he's got a mustache. Yeah,
and Ulysses has like a beard and a tight black tank. And we see him from behind in the first shot, and his butt is very curvy. I don't know what the hell is going on there, but there it was this way that homosexuality could not be separated from it, and it needed to erupt somehow, and it just shows up in these four random panels, and there it is in the issue. And it is a sort of disavowal, right? It says gay doesn't necessarily mean AIDS, and also, by the way, gay doesn't mean happy either. So that just pops in. And then you pointed out that there was, in the letters column, a plea for... Well, why don't you read it?
Well, okay, yeah. In the letters column, they have all... Instead of taking letters from fans, like they usually do, they have comics creators write in about their experiences, relationships to HIV. The only name I really recognized was Jeff Loeb. But then at the very end, they have this purple block of text that says... "We'd like to thank all the creators who took the time to respond, and we'd like to remind all our readers that it is possible to avoid AIDS if you practice abstinence or safe sex, and do not share hypodermic needles with anyone. We also encourage all our readers of the age of consent to avoid casual sex. Explore monogamy. One night of pleasure really isn't worth dying for." And I just thought that was interesting because that's not a tactic that's really, I see... utilized today is monogamy, but I also am a little younger, so I don't know what it was like to be in the heat of the crisis here. So I was wondering really what your thoughts were.
Yeah, I mean, so that was definitely one of the messages that we were getting, and I think it, on a number of different levels, it fails, and at the same time, it kind of addressed some of the prejudices around, you know, even this notion, right? In here, he says, if you guys weren't all hopping bathhouses or whatever he says, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's interesting is that we have the one side saying it's one, you know, the problem causes this. And then in the back, we're saying, oh, maybe that is actually causing the
problem. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, obviously transmission is helped if people are having unsafe sex with multiple partners, you know. And so I think I may have internalized this message to a degree. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning that, you know, I went into a monogamous relationship at like 19. Now, it didn't stay monogamous because at 19 it's really hard to do that. But it was informed by that idea of monogamy as the goal, in part also to prove the prejudice around gay male relationships wrong. But yeah, no, this was like a really funny thing. I think about the George Michael "I Want Your Sex" video. Did you ever see that video? It's pretty great.
I've seen a lot of George Michael's videos, but that one does not spring to mind. No.
Sexy video, it's kind of dance pop song. I want your sex, I want your love. But then people criticized him for releasing a video that was about sex in the time of AIDS. And so in this one sequence where people are showing the sort of naked body parts on a bed with like delicately placed satin sheets, you know, there's a part where he, I think, paints the word like monogamy on the leg of some woman. That was the kind of messaging that we were getting before it became more consistently about safer sex. Well, okay, so like let's fast forward a bit. So it's interesting
about 10 years.
Yeah, so this is now more around your era.
That is true.
And it's another time period that I wasn't reading comics as avidly. I don't even know that I was totally aware that they still existed at this point. But I, you know, because I didn't really come back into them until fairly recently. But it, I find this period really fascinating because I was so out of touch. And I actually really like the way a lot of the art from this era looks. It's such a great time capsule of the early 2000s, which are like a very strange stylistic moment. So this is Green Arrow, a comic book about the character Green Arrow, Oliver Queen, who is the sort of Robin Hood type of the DC universe. The last book we read was, of course, Marvel. And I think that's something maybe we can think about is like how the two different companies sort of had their own stylistic way of thinking about how to talk about AIDS and HIV. But one thing I noticed with DC is that unlike Marvel, they will actually make a character positive. Marvel's tendency is to make a character's friend positive. But here we have a kind of both things happening. So it starts in about issue number 43 of Green Arrow from January, from 05. So it's 04, 05 is when this is kind of going down. And it's written by Judd Winnick, Phil Hester, and Andy Parks is, or Phil Hester and Andy Parks are the art. And I really like Andy Parks' inking, by the way. But why don't you give us a little bit of backstory here? So we are introduced to a character named Speedy, and the author is Judd Winnick.
Yeah, this character was actually created by Kevin Smith, writing for Green Arrow. But and she was introduced as a sort of like runaway sex worker, underaged girl who Ollie takes under his wing and sort of rescues from the streets. And then flash forward to issue 43 in a story by Judd Winnick. She's revealed to be HIV positive. Judd Winnick, of course, also wrote Pedro and Me, which is a comic about Pedro Zamora, his castmate on a season of The Real World San Francisco. Pedro was a HIV activist who lost his life to AIDS. And so when the topic of specific treatments comes up, or when they're talking about medication, antibiotics, stuff like that, it, even though this is comic, it feels like it's becoming very real and literal, and they're using like the actual terminology because I think Judd Winnick had some familiarity in this area. Mm-hmm. And I think also he was interested in exploring with this character because, you know, a young white girl is maybe not who you think of as the face of HIV or AIDS. But at this point, when it starts out, she's sort of just like an associate of the Green Arrows. She's not, she hasn't taken up the mantle of Speedy yet. Right. And, but, you know, she's very close with Oliver and Connor, and Ollie really doesn't handle things very well. Mm-hmm. Especially when she opens up with her schoolmates about it in this school assembly.
Right. Yeah, this character, Mia Dearden, is her name. So, yeah, she was introduced prior. And then Judd Winnick, who, yeah, as you mentioned, did Pedro and Me, which is a pretty well-known comic about his specific experience with Pedro Zamora. When he does that sequence. So first, you know, she reveals her positive status because she finds out that she's positive. She didn't know already, but she did know that it was possible because of how she lived before she became, I guess, his ward, his kind of like, you know, I mean, Speedy's basically Robin of Green Arrow. The previous Speedy was Roy Harper, who it's interesting that because he was an IV drug user.
That's right.
So there's that famous issue where, you know, Speedy is shooting up on the cover and Green Arrow is like freaking out with Green Lantern next to him. And it just feels, I love that cover because it's so like the gay dads are like, oh fuck. But anyway, yeah, as you point out, that particular moment is really interesting because what we see is her coming out and then addressing her entire school and giving them like very specific education around transmission and saying that these are the ways you can't get it and these are the ways you can. And that actually is not so different from the real world San Francisco when Pedro Zamora addresses a school of students and tells them, and Judd was in that scene, and Judd is watching as Pedro articulately tells these people that he got it this way and that he knows that he could die and that he is living with that. And this is very, very closely echoed by what Mia says in this issue when she says, you know, after going through quite a bit of point by point, you know, explaining what HIV/AIDS is in 2005 and how it's different in some ways from what they might assume, and that in fact it's the fastest growing group is heterosexual women. So she gives a lot of information, right? But then she also says, I'm not dying, I'm living with HIV. I'm not someone you should be scared of. You should be very frightened of AIDS, not of people with AIDS. I'm still me. HIV has changed many things in my life, but it hasn't changed who and what I am. I'm still me. Thanks. And then the kids, you know, some of them clap and some of them look at each other like, I don't know. But what is so interesting there to me is how closely it resembles that scene, which is a very important scene in the real world San Francisco, where Pedro is not just addressing the students in the room, but through the vehicle of MTV, he's addressing the whole world.
Yeah, and a little bit through this comic, she's addressing obviously not the same amount of people that were watching the real world, but you know, the audience of this comic is being addressed.
And and a whole new generation. I mean, there are some interesting things that go on here. I think, like, for example, you know, she feels she's trying to protect her relationship with the Green Arrow by not admitting to her own sadness and anxiety and fear. He's also trying to stifle those feelings. And Connor, who is his son, right, who's Oliver Queen's son, he becomes a kind of, you know, the person who can talk to both of them. And there's a point at which she says, you know, I'm infected, who's going to love me? And he kisses her. And then she asks, does this mean you're my boyfriend now? And he says, no. And she says, so was that just one of those symbolic things to make me feel better? And he says, yeah. But, you know, there is this kind of like thing where symbolically that is kind of important. He kisses a person who's HIV positive, showing that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of modeling of behavior here.
A lot of modeling. What I really like that eventually ends up happening here is that she does become Speedy. Right. She becomes a superhero, you know, sort of after the diagnosis even, and sort of maybe a little bit out of just wanting to live her life to the fullest and be the person she wants to be, and even goes on to join the Teen Titans and fight one-on-one against Robin in this whole sequence where she doesn't win, but it's like acknowledged that she's, you know, a talented and exceptional superhero. And that is what I always really liked about this character. And also where I started to have some familiarity with this character, because I did read a Black Canary Green Arrow comic that happened for a while, drawn by Cliff Chang, I remember. And she was very heavily featured in it as just a superhero. And so, you know, just having, you know, show that someone can live with HIV and not just survive, but sort of thrive, thrive with HIV. Yeah,
that's a really good point. I mean, the sequence where she shows up in the costume and he initially says like, no, you can't do this. And she's like, it's different now. And he says, because you have a death wish. And she's like, no, actually, because now I have to make choices, you know, that are significant. I'm more focused on things. And in the narration at the end, when they're both kind of jumping through the city as superheroes, he says, I've often said that I never chose this life. It chose me. I guess it's the same for her. So there you go. You know, with responsibility comes responsibility. Or maybe with responsibility comes great power. You know, it's almost like an inversion of that.
Peter Zamora wasn't always able to talk so freely. Growing up gay, he confided in almost no one.
When I was in seventh grade, a doctor came in to speak to us about HIV and AIDS. It was their disease, not our disease. I remember being there and thinking, well, maybe something I'm doing is putting me at risk, but not feeling comfortable raising my hand.
Her question is, when I told my immediate family, how did they feel?
After a while, I went through a whole process with myself about, okay, maybe I should change my behavior. By the time I did, it was too late. I was already HIV positive. My biggest anger is that I had to go through that whole process by myself.
the X-Men, because they are a metaphor for everything, you know, they can't have AIDS in their stories, even though North Star is in the same planet, you know, that they are. And instead, they end up with a metaphor for AIDS, and that is the Legacy virus, which is, you know, invented by Strife, released into the atmosphere, and it affects mutants only initially anyway. And what it does is it, you know, ruins their immune system and causes them to die, and kind of their DNA unravels and all this sort of stuff. So this is in the, you know, early 90s. Everybody knows what it's a stand-in for. And it becomes a plot point that lasts for like 10 years.
And I also want to say that I received this specific issue of X-Men as a Christmas present when I was 7 years old.
So Uncanny X-Men issue number 303 from 1993 by Lobdell and mm-hmm. Richard Bennett, who is even more 90s than anybody could ever be.
Yes, this is, the art here is so outrageous. I mean, it's like you realize, like, you almost prefer the, like, overly sexualized women to be, like, fighting right. than, like, being emotional with each other. Because when they're, like, hugging and, like, talking about serious stuff, it's like, ooh, what's going on here? This is getting, lesbianic or something.
Yeah, which would be cool if it was, but instead it's just, like, that pervy male gaze thing. Yeah, I don't know. This is particularly hard. I think this entire issue, which is, you know, this is the issue in which Ileana Rasputin dies of the Legacy virus. Mm. And in a way, she kind of has that sort of like the character, like the little boy who wouldn't be let into the school, or like Ryan White, you know, the very famous case of the boy who acquired the infection through a blood transfusion. And, you know, became a kind of cause as a way to understand AIDS without having the politicized homophobic thing happening, or even the race issues happening. So, you know, to me, that was always kind of a weird signal that the X-Men chose to make a character who was, you know, the ultimate innocent, and in fact so innocent that she had once been a devil but had been reverted down to her child self.
She's been so reduced
right, like from the Ileana that we know from New Mutants, who is still the Ileana that everyone loves, as this like,
and is now in the comics again.
Yeah, a very prominent figure in the comics again, this sort of devil teen girl, reduced to this just sort of moppet who has this Legacy virus. And actually the whole issue is really about Jubilee's relationship to her, and to seeing this person die and nobody around her can do anything about
it. Yeah, she's sort of, even though she was once the superhero, now she's like become the friend. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting, you know, North Star is in Alpha Flight. It's a way less popular comic, let's be honest. X-Men is the highest selling comic of all time. Mm-hmm. So in this, it's like they can't just do the AIDS thing. They can't just go that route, you know, is what it feels like. And I think a lot of people I've never sort of explored the Legacy virus thing, because so many people have said, oh, it wasn't a good moment for X-Men.
No, it wasn't. I think the problem is that they were hitting up against some of the limits that we see Metaphor having.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The choices that they made in terms of who got sick, et cetera, were very strategic and never really impacted directly any of the characters who are the most prominent 90s X-Men characters, you know. So it's all deferring. And even to the point where, like, Psylocke's body that isn't Psylocke anymore gets it, you know. Like Madrox dies of it. He's the multiple man. Like, it's all the extra people that get it. And then Ileana, no longer really Ileana, she also dies. And so this is a big problem, I think, just in terms of like how they're framing who is susceptible to the illness, but also that they kind of never really deal with it directly. Though what it does is it permeates X-Men during this period with this like unbelievable feeling of dread, you know, constant dread that somebody's going to get sick. And that, I think, is interesting. But that's more of a side effect. So I'm wondering, like, what did you think of this issue when you were a kid and read this?
Well, I was so little. The main takeaways that I remember having were, so X-Men isn't always about fighting, because there's no... no, like, you know, fight scenes this entire issue. And I think what happened was it was just the issue that was on the shelves at that particular moment. My mom just grabbed it. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, oh, like, let me, like, give you this important issue of X-Men or something. Right. Like, it was, like, the weird thing about this issue is that it jumps around in time a lot. Like, they're jumping back, like, just a few hours or moments before when Jubilee's explaining everything what happened. But then they're also jumping around in time to explain, like, how Ilyana's even like this. So I was just like, whoa, X-Men's, like, so complicated. But, like, other than that, my little 7-year-old brain wasn't wrapping my head around anything else that was going on.
Like, I think that what's interesting here is how it echoes the feeling of that kind of helplessness and sense that anybody at any moment could die. That's here. And then the other thing, you know, when Jean Grey at the end is comforting Jubilee, who's crying in her arms, and yeah, Jean Grey is in kind of a weirdly sexy pose here, squishing Jubilee's face up against her very metallic breast. But with the words here, like, I don't know, you want to read what Jean says?
The time we spend in between, time spent alive, sharing, learning together, is all that makes life worth living.
So there is something.
And she's saying that, she's saying this after she says, you know, we're born alone and we die alone. Yeah.
Legacy virus thing kind of gets wrapped up about 10 years later, or a little less, but in 2001, again written by Scott Lobdell. Salvador La Roca is the artist, and it's X-Men number 390, Uncanny X-Men number 390. And I've always thought this cover was really fascinating. It's, you know, Colossus in full metal, looking very Tom of Finland-y, his crotch in the sort of scent, like, really present in this drawing.
Oh, yeah.
Holding a hypodermic needle, but he's in full metal form, so it's like it wouldn't even go in. But there's this sort of thing where it says on the cover, the legacy virus cured, but at what cost? And basically in that one, Beast finds a cure, and he knows that the only way it's going to work, apparently, is to inject one mutant with this cure. Then it will, like, go out into the world and cure everybody and kill the virus, but that mutant will have to die. And Colossus, who's been mourning his sister for almost 10 years now, decides it's going to be him. And without everybody's knowledge, you know, they're all, like, looking somewhere else, and they're in the kitchen or playing baseball or whatever the X-Men are doing. He shoots himself up with it, and then they find him dead, but the legacy virus is over. And so he's kind of become the sacrifice for it.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, in this case, they did include a major main character in the conversation. At the same time, it's not like he contracted the virus, you know? He's sort of doing this selfless act. At the time, the thing I remember liking kind of about it was that, you know, typically when an X-Men character dies, it's in some fight sequence or some kind of life or death thing like that. Whereas this is, like, completely in a different category of assessing mortality.
Right. One thing I do think about a lot is how superhero bodies are impenetrable and invulnerable, and that's part of the reason why they have such a hard time in comics talking about illness. For superhero comics, that it kind of goes against the very premise of a superhero, that they have the vulnerability to a disease. And I think, you know, it makes me think about the earlier metaphoric virus, but more of a narrative virus, really, that Chris Claremont invented in The New Mutants, and with the character Warlock, who was part of the Technarchy, and the sort of living circuitry. And this anxiety around infection that was always part of his narrative, because people can be infected with the techno-organic virus. Many, many prominent X-Men characters are. And it's an alien sentient kind of circuitry that can lead to death, but it also can lead to a kind of merging with the Technarchy, a kind of, like, multiplied consciousness or something like that. And the relationship between Warlock and Cypher, Doug Ramsey, has so many layers that I think we're thinking about this, you know, in 1986 in the New Mutants Annual Volume 1, Number 2 by Chris Claremont and Alan Davis, which introduces Psylocke, by the way. There's a really extended conversation around this kind of merging and the way that the virus is a risk, but also the way that the connection between these two characters is has so much potential. And so it's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's a much more effective, intentional or not, it feels like a much more effective metonym for for AIDS, because, you know, he's empowered by becoming sort of linked with Warlock, but then there's the risk in the connection, just exactly what you were saying.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, this, by the way, you said you hadn't read this before. What did you think of it? New Mutants Annual number 2.
This is the thing is, Cypher is a character who, okay, so there's this character, New Mutants, for those of you who don't know, who has the power to understand any language, which is a very un-X-Men type power, because it doesn't have anything to do with fighting, really. He seems to come up a lot these days. People are very interested in talking about him, when at the time he was considered, at least by editors and stuff, to be the most hated member of the New Mutants. They would get hate mail about him, and, you know, artists would complain about drawing him because he didn't do anything over the top, you know, physically. But now, like, just thinking about language and communication has become so interesting, and this issue where they're dealing with all these different things is so beautifully drawn by Alan Davis, and just the story is just great, and it's just Chris Claremont's firing on all cylinders. I just feel like I'm in such good hands the entire time. It was just, I just absolutely loved
it. Yeah, I mean, I was really happy to revisit it, because I only kind of remembered parts of it, but looking at this, I mean, this is just such peak X-Men, 1986. It's New Mutants, but of course it's related. Yeah, everything you just said about Cypher, he was definitely one of my favorite characters at the time, because to me, that idea of being able to speak any language, especially coming from a household where there were multiple languages spoken and I didn't have fluency in most of them, it just seemed like what an amazing power. And then the fact that computers were one of the other languages made it possible for him to speak, you know, in a certain intimate way with this alien who was basically like living technology. And so their merger is like happens on so many levels. And what the virus represents is every kind of virus. Like there's the sort of sense of like multiplication of the cell within the host, but there's also the computer virus. And so it just kind of like, this is where I think, yeah, and when you said it could be a metonym, it could be a metaphor, I think you're right. Like it kind of moves way beyond just a simple allegory, right? Which is what the legacy virus is. It is much more complicated, and also allows for a certain kind of world building. So you have this moment that I always remember even as a kid, because one of the things that happens in this issue is Douglas Ramsey, who I thought was really cute when I was younger, and so I don't know, all these like mean people who are mean to this cute blonde teenage boy, he finds Captain Britain, who's been de-aged, naked in an abandoned school or something like that, and he gives him his leotard to wear. So he ends up shirtless through most of this episode, this issue. And I have a lot of thoughts about the panel where, you know, he gives him his leotard to wear, and that there's a lot of thoughts there. But anyways, but if we look at just like the two panels where they decide, Doug decides that he's going to merge with Warlock in order to do something. He says, you know, is it possible? And Warlock says,
possible?
How?
Dangerous?
How?
Selves merge, operate as gestalt, but a high probability exists that such a process may infect self-friend Doug with transmode virus.
There are worse fates.
Humor inappropriate.
That's what you think. Warlock, if my sacrifice means saving the others, then it's a fair exchange. And then they touch hands. And so there's this, you know, shirtless teen boy touching his sort of technology, sort of doppelganger in technology form. Their hands reach out. They touch. And Chris Claremont writes, and Douglas Ramsey Warlock's world spins like the wildest of tops. In that flash, Warlock's physicality merges totally with Doug's. The shape remains roughly the same, but not the substance. From head to toe, every square inch of Doug's body is covered with Warlock's living circuitry, the young alien's techno-organic flesh and blood creating a fantastic synthesis that Doug soon realizes is more than skin deep. And now he sees the world completely differently, you know? So, I mean, there's so many things happening here for me. There's a kind of sexual contact, but then there's also like the potential of like a new kind of consciousness that's offered through technology. There's the possibility that this is going to lead to his death. There's a possibility that it might be worth it. You know, it's like.
And also this idea too, like I think about how at least when I came out, it was an eye-opening experience to just realize like what a joke the like world or the powers that be were. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it was eye-opening in that way, and it opened my eyes to think, like, mm-hmm. oh, like, if this, like, you know, what else is happening in the world? You know yeah. what I mean? Just this idea that, like, if people thought something about me was so profoundly wrong for literally no good reason, like, what else could be going on?
Right.
Super K!
We've revealed that I'm a big fan of this period of Neat Mutants, and that I'm a
we
total,
love it, yeah.
I'm a total Doug Ramsey Cypher person, and I love Warlock too, and blah blah blah. But one thing I guess I just wanted to sort of add to that is in New Mutants issue number 53 from 1987 by Chris Claremont, Rick Leonardi, and Terry Austin, there's a sequence that I found really memorable where Doug is looking in the mirror and he thinks he sees a microchip in his eye, and this is followed by a moment in which he spreads the techno-organic virus through all the New Mutants. He's like in the bathroom in his towel, you know, looking in the mirror, and he thinks he's turning into basically a kind of techno-organic person. He spreads the virus and kills everybody in his friend group. But then he realizes it was a dream, and he was still human. He looks in the mirror in his towel, but then there's a sort of close-up, and it shows that there is, in fact, a circuit in his eye. This is one of the reasons why I thought he was definitely going to become a kind of circuitry guy. But the other thing here was, I think this was an even more articulate and focused kind of conversation around what it feels like to suspect that you may have an illness and that you may in fact be a vector of that illness. And the hope you have that it's not true, the possibility that it is, and this really intimate moment of like just looking at yourself in the mirror and wondering that, I think this particular issue articulates really kind of spectacularly, frighteningly, actually. And it, to me, this was like, this is what's missing in a lot of ways from the conversation around the legacy virus.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of just recalls for me how an earlier parts of my life, like pretty much every time I got sick, I thought I had HIV.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really think I did, but it was in the back of my mind.
Right. Exactly. And that's going to be, I think, for a lot of us, how we feel about getting a cold, you know,
yeah,
right now.
Going forward in the current times. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's just this thing where, like, you know, that fantasy that the superhero offers you, that your body is something that can resist anything. One of the reasons all the teen boys hated Doug was that he didn't fulfill that. And he, even to this degree, he is a vulnerable character, which is why it's such an important character, I think, in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
Did want to mention really quickly that there was a series of comics put together by Bill Sienkiewicz and others, Trina Robbins, in the 80s, Strip AIDS USA and Strip AIDS UK. Did you get a chance to ever look at these?
I couldn't find a way to read them. I couldn't find a way to read them online myself.
Yeah, I ended up buying a copy of Strip AIDS USA and looked at it. It's really interesting as a snapshot of the time. Of course,
yeah, I would love to.
Artists in there are really looking much more closely and directly at it, but it's also strips, so it's like one-page, you know, books or one-page projects.
Yeah.
And Alan Davis, who we had just been talking about how much we loved his work on the New Mutants annual, he offers a one page with a story and pictures by Alan Davis and words by Richard Starkings. Why don't you read it, actually?
He still has time for the people. His powers amaze them. Flight, super speed, laser vision, ultrasonic hearing. His fans would say that there is nothing he cannot do.
Yum, what a hunk. What a nice man. leave him and me alone, and are you kidding? Haven't you heard?
But they would be wrong. He is not invulnerable. He can be hurt, injured, made sick, infected. And he hasn't got a power that can combat bigotry and prejudice. He can't save them from their fear of the unknown. They have to do that for themselves. Super Gay is recorded by Coastally in Alex's studio in New York City, New York, and the Razorcake Studios in Los Angeles, California. To support Super Gay and get exclusive insight and content from our Super Gay world, go to patreon.com/supergays with a Z. Super Gay is brought to you by Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema, where Dave White and Alonzo Duralde, two film critics who are married, discuss and debate each week's movies with wit and aplomb. Find out more about Linoleum Knife at www.patreon.com/linoleumknife. Super Gay is also brought to you by Razorcake Fanzine, a volunteer-run nonprofit punk rock fanzine published bi-monthly out of Los Angeles, California.
Super K.